Good morning and welcome to the last of the legal ethics sessions for 2019. For those I don't know, I see a couple of people actually. I'm Mordechai Torshiner with the Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, and we are happy to be able to provide among our educational offerings in the community classes for professionals in the areas of their professions approved for continuing education credit. In this case, the Law Society has approved the session for 1.5 professionals in credits, which means I get 90 minutes, and so do you. Hopefully you look at it that way. Please make sure that you sign in. There are sign-in sheets somewhere over there. There were a few of them. So make sure that you sign in. In particular, if you want credit, because if you come to me later and say, I was there, that really isn't good enough. We are going to have somebody come in and take a couple of pictures, and that will help. But if I don't know your name and face, then it's not going to work, I'm sure. Also, signing in gets you on the email list for future legal ethics classes. In the event that you check the last box, then it also gets you emails for other programs that are not from legal ethics. I'd ask people to please silence their phones. That would be a big help. Thank you. I fully recognize that someone will come in after that announcement and their phone will be on and it will ring. Nonetheless, it's still a good idea. Nothing that I say should be taken as legal advice. I am not a lawyer, and frankly, even if I were a lawyer, I would still say that. Nothing should be taken as legal advice. Also, nothing that I say should be taken as a specific halachic ruling for a particular case. I'm trying to discuss general issues, but individual cases really need case-specific guidance. Finally, I also put some flyers out for a big program coming up on the Wednesday of Hanukkah, also known as December 25th. It is a day-long program, Tanakh Book of Failures, ? We will be having 30-minute classes on different stories from Tanakh that involve apparent failure and what we're supposed to learn from them. It's a free program, runs 9 o'clock until 4:30. You can come for half an hour, you can come for the whole day. There's a free pizza lunch, but you do have to sign up online in advance. So you can see those flyers, you can take the flyers. Okay. Morning. So there are more source sheets still, I believe, in the pile in the middle. Topic this morning is advising a risk-tolerant client. And you see in item number one here on the sheet, the agenda that I filed with the Law Society for this, so the professionalism topics we're going to cover are recognizing and being sensitive to client circumstances, special needs, and intellectual capacity. They give you a series of examples. Managing difficult clients, and we'll talk about that. And conducting effective client interviews and client meetings, including theory and practical application. What this is going to mean in practice are that I'd like to look at the following issues. Number one, when a lawyer has a client who is, as I put it in the title, risk tolerant, to put it more explicitly, you have a client who insists on going to court, who does not wish to settle, or is making demands or setting expectations that are simply unrealistic. What exactly is the lawyer's obligation in terms of advising that client, particularly where, frankly, the lawyer will do better in the end in the event that the client does not take the advice? The client insists on pursuing litigation, that will end up running fees higher, potentially. So that's one question is, what is the lawyer's obligation in advising that client? Second, if a client makes decisions recklessly, impulsively, when does that become incapacity? At what point, and what's the procedure for saying, you know, this client is not able to make these decisions? Third, may a lawyer withdraw from representation if she strongly disagrees with the client's decisions? And then, hopefully there's some time at the end, we'll talk about presenting an argument to a risk-tolerant client in a way that will maximize the possibility that the client is actually going to listen and take the advice. So those are the areas that I like to touch on. And as always, based in the general system, the law society, and rulings in particular cases, as well as from the perspective of halacha, from the perspective of Jewish law. So that's more or less where I want to go with this. We're going to start out with cases. I got tired of making up my own cases and decided to take them from real life ones, and the names have not been changed to protect the innocent. You see them there on the sheet, the starting where it says number two, vignettes. This is a case, you can see it here, DeVries Smith Frank. Had an issue involving a client who indeed pursued a case beyond the point where it was realistic to do so. And we're going to go through it quickly here from the particular ruling that I brought up. In February 2009, Mr. Chopra raised health and safety concerns with his employer, which he says were ignored. His employer is Easy Plastic Containers. They terminated his employment. In the termination letter, they accused him of conspiring to make false and slanderous accusations, creating a poisoned workplace. At the time of termination, he's earning a salary of approximately $48,000. He receives no severance. He is emotionally devastated, suffers a severe depression. He is actually hospitalized. He's not able to seek a new job. He meets with lawyers from DSF. They ultimately, there's a little back and forth there which I skipped. It doesn't relate to our discussion. But he first goes to them. He wants to get a contingency fee system. They don't want it. And he tries to get somebody else. He ends up coming back to DSF. And they had a statement of claim issued. In his action, he claims damages of $100,000. Before the issuance of the claim and thereafter, there was no discussion between lawyer and client of the risks and rewards of suing for $100,000 in the Superior Court of Justice. He testified that he was told that the total cost of the litigation would not exceed $30,000. However, I find as a fact that no such assurance was given to him. I find as a fact there was no discussion about the financial risks of losing. So they didn't say to him, We're gonna make sure that your costs are capped at $30,000. On the other hand, they didn't say to him, you know, you can lose, or that's what it sounds like right now, or here are the risks involved in trying to pursue $100,000. Litigation is ongoing. The amount of the invoices from the litigation is $117,939. A problem when you're pursuing $100,000, right? We can do math. On June 19, 2014, Justice Sanderson released her judgment. She dismissed the action. Easy Plastic Containers can claim costs of nearly $100,000. The judge awards $25,000 on a partial indemnity basis. Here's the key paragraph now. During the two-year run-up to the trial, the client was adamant that he wished to have his day in court. He testified he was told his claim was strong. Easy Plastic Containers would pay a portion of his costs. However, underlined, I find as a fact. Now, here I added in the word not in brackets because I don't understand how to read the sentence without the word not. I cut and pasted it off of Canly. It should be right the way it is. But if anybody can show me how the sentence makes sense without the word not, I would be in your debt. Reading it the way it was in the decision, I find as a fact that although DSF did tell Mr. Chopra that the unsuccessful party typically pays costs to the winner, they told him that there was a serious risk that he would be unsuccessful and that litigation is risky and outcomes cannot be predicted with any certainty. You see why I'm confused?
No.
You think it's right the way it was?
Yeah.
Although they told him that he would end up, if he loses, paying costs, they told him there was a risk he would be unsuccessful. That shouldn't be an although.
No, they told him that the loser pays the winner's costs. And then they also told him that there was a risk.
Oh, in other words, the unsuccessful party being the other guy.
Not only that, but he's going to seriously lose. He's got a bad case.
Well, leave aside his bad case for the moment. But you. Hang on.
Because he was claiming that he had been assured that they would pay a portion of his costs. So, yes, he was told that the winner pays the loser will pay the winner's cost.
Got it. Okay, so unsuccessful party there is what the client assumes is the other guy, Easy Plastic Containers. That is usually what we assume, right? The unsuccessful party is the other guy, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't be there in the lawyer's office. Okay, so then the way to read it is without the word not. Thank you for that. I find as a fact that although DSF did tell him that the unsuccessful party typically pays costs to the winner, and therefore he can expect, you know, for himself, he thinks to himself, that the other guy is the one who's going to end up paying his costs, they told him there was a serious risk that he would be unsuccessful, and that litigation is risky, and outcomes cannot be predicted with any certainty, and therefore he could also lose. I find that DSF encouraged the client to settle his claim because of the risks of losing. I find that a mediator told him much the same thing. Unfortunately, the client, who likely was continuing to suffer from a depression, could not be reasoned with. He was too emotionally invested in his claim and misunderstood warnings as assurances. He wanted his day in court. He was obsessive. He wanted revenge or vindication. So the question that I have for you here in this case is, how much does the lawyer have to do when presented with a client who is visibly convinced that he's going to win and is going on that basis in a case in which you have to know, if you're DSF, you have to know the costs on your side alone are going to reach somewhere in the ballpark and in fact exceeded the $100,000 that he's trying to win. Not to mention the tremendous risk. Mark says that he has a bad case already. The tremendous risk that he could end up being saddled with Easy Plastic Container's legal fees as well. So, what's the extent of the obligation here for them? Comments.
Well, he went to CAMH, right? So he had obviously had mental health issues. So I think you have to speak with the doctors there. Or he's obviously being assessed by medical professionals. Why shouldn't they give a diagnosis as to his competency and capacity?
So you're thinking already that there would be a need to get his permission to go back to CAMH. I'm imagining what the client does when the lawyer says that to them.
They wouldn't give you any information anyway.
Well, the question would be what the client is willing to allow. But I'm just imagining the conversation in the law office when you say to the client, I'm interested in your case, but I want to go talk to your doctor first to make sure you have the capacity to
proceed with this. Well, in this case, you get his medical records. And, it's deemed undertaking. You're not allowed to use them for other things, but you can use it to assess whether or not he is mentally
competent. Right, but I would think you would need his permission in order to pursue that.
Absolutely. Or it gives a third party.
Yeah.
That's about the past. You have to assess him now. Just because he was in there and just because he didn't have capacity then doesn't mean he doesn't have capacity now.
Right. No, but that will require an assessment. I don't know, and I don't think anybody reading this case knows what the after effects were and what he was still dealing with after he was hospitalized. That's not clear. You had your hand up? No?
Yeah. Beyond the assessment itself. I had a client like this the other day, actually, where you just don't get through to them. And you have to, I think, it's on you still to explain the risks of the litigation. And if it's not getting through to them, then
what?
In writing, I guess, to cover your own
mind. No, you can't do anything beyond that. That's what I was going to say as well.
Yeah.
After you have a discussion, you write in writing, you send them an email, and you say, listen, I just want to explain to you again, these are the risks. And it's not a sure thing by any means.
Right. So two people have now mentioned getting it in writing. That's going to be really important. It seems obvious, but watch what happens in this case. So let's start talking about the specifics here. We're going to skip the other vignettes. We're going to come back to them when we deal with each aspect of this issue. So as we go through each part, we'll go through the introductory case. So jump to source number 3, please. It's on the third page. Okay. I should mention, I didn't mention in the beginning, but I'm grateful to the Bayit for hosting this program. I'm also grateful to Yeshivat Or Chaim for their copier and all the paper that went into this. So, source number 3 is fairly obvious, but I bring it anyway because it's a good presentation of what the obligations of a lawyer are. The obligations of a lawyer are, I think, the following from a 1964 ruling, which has quoted quite a bit. To be skillful and careful, to advise his client on all matters relevant to his retainer, so far as may be reasonably necessary, to protect the interests of his client, to carry out his instructions by all proper means, to consult with his client on all questions of doubt which do not fall within the express or implied discretion left to him, and to keep his client informed to such an extent as may be reasonably necessary according to the same criteria. The point that I'm bringing here is that giving advice, you know, is here to advise his client on all matters as far as may be reasonably necessary, is basic and fundamental to the obligations of a lawyer. It isn't a matter of just saying, here are my instructions, the client says, and the lawyer is saying, okay, I'm going to do them. You do have the obligation, yes, you have an obligation to carry out the instructions, but you also have the obligation to provide that advice. And interestingly, the advice may well go beyond legal advice. The advice may even extend to advice regarding the business that this person is pursuing. I was very surprised when I saw this in source number 4. Wang v. 407527 Ontario Limited. I'll give you the background on the case. Someone wanted to invest in commercial real estate, and they wanted to buy a particular property which had a bunch of tenants. And the property was owned by this numbered corporation that you see here. And the real estate market was very hot at the time, and they thought for sure they're going to do really well with this. And this numbered corporation, the people running it, represented to them that the tenants in the commercial real estate were certainly going to stay. And they even warranted for them the first year's rent from the tenants. The tenants, after the sale of the property, many of them vacated. Some of them were still there, didn't pay their rent, but some of them left. So the purchaser, this fellow Wang, goes back to 407527 and says, I want the rent money that you guaranteed me was coming. There was no security for it, and they never got it. They weren't able to get it. They came back to, as part of this, they came back to their lawyer who had been involved in the drafting the agreement. And that's the part that's relevant here. The lawyer who drafted the agreement did not advise them to get security for the rent money that was being guaranteed to them. So take a look at source number 4 here from the decision. The judge says, I do not, however, rest my concern about, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Sorry? You? Okay. Hugh's duty to negotiate security on any distinction between business advice and legal advice. In other words, I need to give one more step of background. This person who got involved in the drafting of the agreements was involved after the initial conversations, only became after the initial conversations about guaranteeing the rent. And that's why the judge says, well, it wasn't his problem to advise you on it because it was too late when he got involved. But what the judge wants to stress here is that she is not holding Hugh responsible because of when Hugh got involved. But had Hugh been involved at the time when the agreements were being negotiated, Hugh would have been responsible to give business advice to Wang. Hugh submitted he had no duty to negotiate security for the warranty because this was a business matter, not part of a lawyer's retainer. I do not accept this submission. Although ordinarily clients retain lawyers for legal advice, not business advice, on some transactions the two are intermingled and no clear dividing line can be drawn. Thus, a lawyer may well have a duty to give advice on the financial or business aspects of a transaction depending on the client's instructions and sophistication, and on whether the client is relying on the lawyer for that kind of advice. So you have to make a judgment call when you enter into this business with them of what kind of advice do they want from me, and consider that they may be expecting more than just legal advice. If you have experience in particular in a certain area, they may be expecting you to give advice on that area. Alan?
It's not clear from this, but the obligation is to advise of business risks, not to give business advice. So the risk is if you don't have security, you may not be able to recover. But in fact, I think our insurance does not cover us for giving business advice. And if you give negligent business advice, your insurance may not cover you. So again, you've got to advise of risks, not give advice in aviation.
So I think I hear your distinction, but at the same time, telling them you should get security on that fundamentally is business advice.
No, well, yeah.
Why is it legal advice?
Peripherally, but it's advising them of a risk that can occur.
Security is a legal advice, yeah. Once they make the decision that they're guaranteeing that year's rent, that's a business decision. But in order to provide security is a legal decision.
That's interesting. So why does the judge think that this is business advice?
It's poorly worded.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There's a more recent case. I think it's 2014. The lawyer involved, the name would be known here, so maybe I won't say it.
Thank you. This is being recorded especially.
It was a case, I think it was an investment decision, and I don't think he came out of it very well under the circumstances. So I'm just saying there may be a more
case. Right. I hear the point about, you know, the risks of entering into business advice and that being potentially even a vulnerability for the lawyer if the lawyer does. I'm just looking at this, and this wasn't the only case I saw. This happened to be a very easy one to capture. But the concern in general is consistent with what we say in fields of law beyond this, and the client-lawyer relationship, which is that the lawyer has to be sensitive to what the client is, in fact, relying on. It even goes beyond the client, right? We had a session last year, the year before, on dealing with a self-represented client on, not client, but a self-represented litigant on the other side, who comes to expect that you're going to tell them things, and how careful you have to be to make sure that they know what it is that you're doing, and what your role is, and what your role is not. Moshe, you were asking something before, and then Jerry.
Yeah, I think it's based on two beforehand. Advise the client all matters relevant to the retainer.
Yeah.
So the word is as far as may be necessary, reasonably necessary. The question is it reasonably necessary according to the client, or is it reasonably necessary according to the lawyer?
According to the client, it sounds like. You have to know what the client is thinking.
Right. As said, it could be the lawyer, what he feels is necessary, or it could be a client. That would actually affect this case,
mm-hmm.
because whether the lawyer was required. So I'm not sure what it means, but it depends on what that reasonably
right. Right. Understood, but I do think that's what I've read is that it is client based. Jerry,
I think here it's pretty clear you're getting a warranty from a numbered company, and that's a sort of a legal obligation to explain what the limits of a warranty and the limits of a numbered company.
Yes, it's actually very funny because in the ruling, the judge mentions the concern about it being a numbered company, making it a little more important to get the security. So I know nothing about numbered companies, so I started looking online and I found all sorts of websites saying, no, numbered companies are just as trustworthy and just as safe and so on. But the judge clearly didn't think so. This being entirely beyond the realm of my expertise, I did. There, it's in paragraph 47. It's the next paragraph in that ruling. The judge makes the point about it being a numbered company and having some concerns on that front. What does emerge is that the lawyer has to give reliable advice, has to be sensitive to the client's expectations for that advice, and that's why you get in source number 5 from the Rules of Professional Conduct in the section on competence, competent lawyer means a lawyer who has and applies relevant knowledge, skills, and attributes in a manner appropriate to each matter undertaken on behalf of a client, including knowing general legal principles and procedures, the substantive law and procedure for the areas of law in which the lawyer practices, investigating facts, identifying issues, ascertaining client objectives, considering possible options, developing and advising the client on appropriate courses of action. All of that comes under the heading of being a competent lawyer, and a lawyer shall perform any legal services undertaken on a client's behalf to the standard of a competent lawyer. It's no surprise, certainly. A lawyer who fails to advise properly will face a potential allegation of not having been competent, but also even a concern for self-dealing. The concern that they're looking to help themselves by not giving full advice. There's a specific obligation for a lawyer in number 6, which we've discussed also on other occasions, to advise settlement. A lawyer shall advise and encourage the client to compromise or settle a dispute whenever it is possible to do so on a reasonable basis, and shall discourage the client from commencing or continuing useless legal proceedings. Why is that? mean, it's obvious, but say it. Why is that?
Because if he loses, he can't afford it.
Well, one is for the sake of the client, and the other is?
For the system.
For the sake of the system, correct. It's not just about this client. It's also about the system as a whole. Having given that advice, now it's up to the client to listen or not listen. So if you take a look at source number 7, you find a case in which, indeed, the lawyer has given the advice. And then we're told the first duty of an agent is to comply explicitly with the orders of his principal. If the following of those instructions involves the abandonment by the principal of his statutory protection, surely the principal cannot complain. If you gave the advice, and then the client said, I don't care, and this is what I want you to do, at that point, your job is done. Your job is just starting, but you've given the warning, and now it's up to you to carry out what the client says. So coming back to our case, the case that we brought in the vignette, where they did say that if the other guy loses, then they'll end up having to pay your costs. They also noted you may not win. Take a look at number 8 here from the ruling. There was no discussion between lawyer and client that the client's upside was net $5,000 and their downside was approximately $148,000. I skipped all the math. You can look up the ruling and find it for yourself. I appreciate that the client was adamant in having a day in court, and I believe that DSF's lawyers were well-intentioned in agreeing to defer payment of the firm's accounts until he had his day in court. But these good intentions were a trap and a recipe for the financial disaster that followed. The deferred retainer ran the risk that a poor family would be out on the street having lost everything. If DSF was not prepared to act on a matter based on a contingency fee, under which they would bear some of the risks, they cannot expect to be fully paid in the absence of having made it perfectly clear that it will be foolish for the client to sue having regard to the risks and rewards of litigation. So, in other words, the judge finds they did not do enough to advise advise him of the potential risks, and as a result, the judge cuts down what they can demand for costs. That was what we had back in the vignette where I brought it, where the judge says that they're going to get $25,000 instead of all of that they had asked for, whatever that number was, $117,939.20. So they didn't go far enough, and the result was that they were not able to claim the full fee from the client. Yeah.
Is it relevant that they're from a poor family? Do they need to know that their client is poor, or do they have to do the math beforehand whether he's rich or poor? I think
it sounds like they're expected to be sensitive to the needs of the client, and this is part of that. Yeah, I would think so. One of the pieces that we're going to see is the importance of giving advice that's tailored to the client. And I think the client's financial situation would be relevant in such a case.
Now, all these cases you mentioned are litigation cases, but I think it applies to many other situations, because I've had cases where I could have earned substantial legal fees, but I told the client, you know, the risk is too great, and therefore they agreed not to pursue it.
Mm-hmm. Correct. This has application beyond this band of cases that I'm bringing here. Absolutely true. There's also a separate issue, which is not really part of the discussion this morning, but bringing the legal profession into bad reputation is a separate concern, but I think a very significant one. Too late, Michael says. Okay. So we've spent the last 27, 28 minutes or so discussing this from the Law Society's perspective. Let's take a look from the halachic perspective, from the perspective of Jewish law. What would one be required to do? So we're going to see this in three different ways. The first way is really very simple and straightforward, which is you, the lawyer, enter into an agreement with the client. The client has certain expectations for how you're going to conduct yourself. You're going to do the job of being a lawyer, hired you with the expectation you're going to give advice the way that a lawyer is supposed to give it, and therefore, potentially from a halachic perspective, from the vantage point of Jewish law, you are in breach of an agreement if you don't meet the standard that the client was expecting. The same way that if somebody hires you to do anything, from a Jewish law perspective, you made a promise that you're going going to do what was expected. If you don't do that, then you're going to be in trouble. That's simple and straightforward. But there's a second concern, and this is the concern involved in giving inappropriate advice. What is the law within Judaism, the Hebrew term for giving somebody bad advice? Sorry? Yep. Lifnei iver lo sitein michshol. The basic version of this, we'll see there's another way to look at it, but the most basic version of it is lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, which means do not put a stumbling block in front of the blind. If you take a look at source number 9, you see the biblical verse. Do not curse the deaf. Do not put a stumbling block before the blind. You shall revere God. I am God. That's the biblical verse. And the Midrash on it, the rabbis in source number 10, explained, don't think of this sentence as saying, literally, there are people who can't see. Don't put something in front of them that's going to cause them to stumble. It extends to giving people bad advice. Source number 10, the Midrash on this says, I'm going to stick with my English translation as opposed to reading the Hebrew out loud in the interest of time, but I did give you the original as well. If someone asks you for advice, do not advise him in a way that is inappropriate for him. Do not tell him, depart in the early morning, such that thieves will attack him, or depart at noon, so that he'll be overcome by heat. And it goes on. There's more to the source than that. It talks about advising somebody who wants to sell off his, he wants to sell off property in order to make some money quickly. So you tell him, sell your field, and you can sell it for my donkey. I'll trade you my donkey for your field. Something which I think you can see is obviously bad advice, generally speaking. We wouldn't trade in real estate for a donkey. But the principle is don't give bad advice. And Ramoses Maimonides, in source number 11, it goes really far with this. He stakes out a remarkable position. If I were to ask you, you saw the verse in source number 9 that says, don't put a stumbling block in front of the person who's not able to see, right? And now you see the rabbinic application to giving bad advice. If I asked you, what's the original intent, the most basic literal intent of that sentence of, do not put a stumbling block in front of someone who can't see, would you have said that the application is to putting stumbling blocks in front of people who can't see? Or do you have assumed that the original intent was to refer to bad advice, to giving bad advice? Which would have been the read of the sentence, logically?
The former.
Yeah. So Michael says it's bad advice. Miriam says no, it's the former. It's the actual stumbling block. I would have assumed it's the stumbling block, right? It's telling you you're causing somebody to fall. Take a look at source number 11. Look at what Moses Maimonides, the Rambam, does when he presents this mitzvah. This is in his Sefer HaMitzvot, where he lists the Torah's mitzvot, and he comes up to mitzvah number 299. The 299th mitzvah is, it's really the 299th prohibition, it's in his prohibition half of the book of mitzvot, is that God commanded that some of us not cause others among us to stumble via advice. And among these aspects of the law, they stated regarding a creditor and borrower with interest, meaning, you know that the Torah prohibits lending on interest. If you participate in such a loan, whether by lending somebody and charging interest, or by borrowing money and paying interest, either way, both of them violates the rule, do not put a stumbling block before the blind. Aside from violating the prohibition against engaging in an interest, a loan with interest, because each of them aids the other and lays the groundwork for him to complete the transgression. You follow? In other words, he says, there's a prohibition against lending money and charging interest. There's even a prohibition against borrowing money and paying interest on it. But in addition to that, by being a party to the loan, I am enabling the other guy to violate the law, and therefore I'm responsible for his violation, and then you get the key line for us. And regarding many cases like this, they said, he violates, do not put a stumbling block before the blind, and the simple meaning of the text is what we mentioned first. In other words, he says, the simple read, pashte dekra in the original Hebrew here, the simple meaning of this prohibition is, don't give bad advice. That's the actual prohibition. not the stumbling block, not the physical stumbling block. That's his. That's a very remarkable argument. The Minchas Chinuch commenting on this has a nice long discussion about it. It has certain ramifications which are beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about right now. But he's saying that the core prohibition is don't give people bad advice. Miriam.
So the fact that the pasuk doesn't say don't put a stumbling block before your fellow man, but says before the blind, implies in this legal context before the unsophisticated.
Ah.
If somebody was very sophisticated and you were their legal advisor, would that put things in a different light?
That's a great question. Miriam asks, what if the person is sophisticated? So I'm going to come back to that in a moment. I wanted to make one point first, and then I'm going to come back to that. The point that I wanted to make first is, from the biblical language, do not put a stumbling block there. I would have assumed that that means that it's only if you actively provide bad advice. Right? Let's go back to the case involving this fellow Wang, right, who didn't get the warning about the security. It wasn't that somebody said to him, yeah, go ahead, you don't need security. They just didn't tell him that he needed the security. So maybe the argument should be, omission is not the same thing as giving bad advice. However, Rabbi Yehuda Rosanis, the Mishnah Lamelech, commenting on Maimonides, says, no, even failure to advise counts as giving bad advice. He's commenting on a rule. The Maimonides writes, there is a basic biblical prohibition called kilayim. The prohibition of kilayim includes, among other things, that a Jew is not allowed to graft two different species to each other. So within a species is fine. However, two different species, you wouldn't be, I'm going to make something up that I don't think works, but you took a branch from an orange tree and you grafted it onto an apple tree, that's actually prohibited. God designed this species, this way, don't mess around with it. That's a basic prohibition. Why it's so is a great discussion for another time. But his point is this. What if a Jew has an orchard and a non-Jewish person says, I'm going to come in and I'm going to graft the trees for him in his orchard. The prohibition against grafting is understood to apply to Jews and non-Jews. The prohibition against causing somebody to stumble applies also if it's a non-Jew. It doesn't distinguish in this regard. So Maimonides writes, you can't let a non-Jew graft your trees in a prohibited way. Apparently, Rabbi Rosanis writes, Maimonides, believes that this is prohibited even without instructing the non-Jew to do it. One may not let him do it. This is because since the non-Jew is prohibited from this action, allowing him to do it would violate do not put a stumbling block before the blind. So in other words, you didn't tell him to graft, but even allowing him to do so without telling him, hey, that's not allowed, is problematic, is in fact prohibited. So what you learn here is that the prohibition against bad advice includes failure to advise. Even if I just see somebody who is going to make a mistake and I don't advise him, I have violated a prohibition. The specific case that Rabbi Rosanis is commenting on is actually a little bit controversial in terms of the laws of grafting and whether they apply to non-Jews or only to Jews. Is it one of the mitzvot that are for all human beings? I'm not going into the specifics of that case as much as recognizing the principle that he establishes, which is brought as law, Rabbi Yaakov Breisch, more contemporarily, in his Chelkas Yaakov legal work. So I'm not allowed to give bad advice. I'm not even allowed to fail to advise. When my client says, I want to pursue this action, I am responsible, not me, because again, I'm not a lawyer, but I would be responsible to make sure to give him proper advice on this. So now we come back to Miriam's point. The text that began this said, don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. What if the person isn't? What if the person is, you know, understands what's going on? Does the rule still apply? So take a look at source number 13, which would seem to indicate the rule still does apply. This is a line from the Rambam, from Moses Maimonides. There were several that I could have chosen. I chose one that I thought expressed things very simply. It's related to a law in the Torah called the law of shatnez. The Torah prohibits wearing clothing that has a mixture of wool and linen in it. Why? The Torah does not explain why. Right? There are all sorts of very interesting explanations. My favorite being that if you go back to Cain and Hevel, they, at the time of creation and right after that, they bring their offerings to God, and Cain brings of the fruit of the land, which we're taught is actually, he brings flax, from which you make linen. Hevel brings from the sheep, which produce wool, and that results in right? The first murder is when Cain kills Hevel after they bring their offerings to God, and one offering is accepted, one is not. So therefore, don't mix wool and linen. There are a variety of explanations. But the bottom line is you're not allowed to do it. So the question is, what if you put this forbidden clothing called shatnez on somebody else? Who's liable? One who clothes another with shatnez. If you put shatnez on somebody, if the one wearing it does so intentionally, that person is lashed, and the one providing the clothing transgresses. Do not put a stumbling block before the blind. If the person who is wearing the clothing knows what he's doing, the one who provides it is still liable for having put a stumbling block before the blind. I don't understand. Right? You just told me that that it's only if the person is not able to see. This person knows that the clothing is shatnez.
But isn't that ain't shaliach ledvar aveira in
the case? Well, he's not a shaliach. He's actually doing it.
But the aveira is done by the person who's wearing it. So,
right.
So how can they both have an aveira?
Because it's two different aveirot. Miriam asks, we do have a principle in Jewish law which says there's no such thing as sinning by proxy. Meaning, if I tell somebody else to go do something wrong, he's the one, or she, is the one who is liable, not me. They made their own decision to do it, barring a case where I forced them into it, but assuming they acted of their own free will, if I tell somebody to go do something wrong, they are the ones who are liable. However, the liability here is for putting a stumbling block before this person by providing that person with the shatnez clothing, even though they knew what it was. So why in the world is this called putting a stumbling block in front of them? They knew what they were doing was prohibited. It was their decision.
It doesn't make sense. Quite honestly, you can sell anybody shatnez whoever you want. As long as they're informed they have to get the shatnez out, you can sell them whatever. Now, if the person doesn't want to take the shatnez out and wears it, you're not responsible at all.
So Moshe, you may not be disagreeing with Maimonides. There's a difference between selling somebody something and actually physically putting it on them. And I think that will be the distinction here. I agree that if you sell someone something and you give them a full warning, then you have no problem in this regard. It's where your involvement is more direct that we have a concern. This comes up in other contexts, as I mentioned.
But you can sell clothing with shatnez?
As long as they inform the person that it needs to be checked and shatnez would have to be removed, the answer seems to be yes.
But in this sense, aren't they blind in the sense that they don't understand the importance of these thoughts?
So Bill takes this a step further. So, Rabbi Chaim Odzer, in source number 14, Rabbi Chaim Odzer Grudzinski offers the following suggestion to explain why it is that one would be liable for putting a stumbling block if the person knows that this is, in fact, prohibited. He offers a very interesting explanation. He said, one could say, number 14, that in the case of before the blind, right, as we're calling it, lifnei iver, in the case of before the blind, there are two types. There is simple before the blind, putting a stumbling block before him, giving him inappropriate advice, which is only relevant when done to one who is unaware. That the blind victim is unaware, and the one who asks for advice does not know himself that the advice is inappropriate for him. In other words, let me just digest that. One type of lifnei iver is where it's bad advice for the person who is involved. Someone came to you, wanted to know, should I engage in this business, should I do this, whatever it is, and it's about whether it's good or bad for him. That's one type of lifnei iver. But then there's another type, which is talking about where what is involved is violation of a law of the Torah. In other words, let me say it a little differently. There's the guy who says, I want to sell some property, and you give him advice that's bad for him personally. You tell him, sell your land for my donkey. It's going to be a bad result for him on a very substantive physical level. At material level is probably a better way to phrase that. As opposed to when you give somebody advice that's going to lead them to violate a religious obligation, lead them to violate a mitzvah, like you put the shatnez on that person. That's a different story. There is another kind of before the blind with prohibitions, like extending a cup of wine to a nazir, someone who has vowed not to drink wine, where even if the sin is intentional, one violates still before the blind. This is a law of before the blind which is unique to prohibitions. You see the distinction he's making? There are two different types of stumbling. There's stumbling which is bad for you materially, and there is stumbling which is bad for you spiritually. And his argument is that causing someone to stumble materially only applies in the event that the person is truly ignorant of the risk. However, causing someone to stumble spiritually applies even if they are aware of the risk. Why? He continues to say, perhaps regarding prohibitions, the reason is that even the one who sins intentionally is like a blind person. For, quote, one does not transgress unless a spirit of foolishness enters him. It's a line from the Talmud. Meaning, if a person knew that something was prohibited and truly, you know, wasn't drawn into the transgression by a desire for whatever it is, that person would never transgress. You'd say, well, the law says don't do it. It's that you get suckered into doing something that's inappropriate. That's the way that the Talmud looks at it. That when people sin, it's because they were overtaken by a spirit of foolishness. So he says, the fact that somebody is aware something is prohibited doesn't mean that he's going to follow the law. He could still get drawn in. He could still be persuaded by desire. Therefore, he's going to make a distinction. In the event that the advice you give is bad practical advice, then you're only responsible if the guy was truly unaware of it, of the risk. So in a case like ours, going back to the case with DeVry Smith Frank, where it's about it being bad for this person, if the person is truly aware that there is a risk, you've done your duty. You're not called giving bad advice. You're not called violating lifnei iver. However, if the risk involved to the person is they're going to be violating a mitzvah, then even if they are aware of that on their own, you're still responsible to give them advice.
Being the two of passive versus active.
Yeah.
If you just put the order of things in this way, you say, v'hafnil l'recha kamocha. So he doesn't, you're not actively doing it. You have a duty to love him like yourself. So if you love him like yourself, you're going to inform him that he, and it's not going to be that point, it's going to be active. So I just try to juxtapose the two in the order of them.
So I'm going to come back to what you're saying, because I'm not quite there yet. Another couple of minutes, I'll be back to that.
I think we can cancel Rosh Hashanah based on this.
You can cancel Rosh Hashanah based on this.
Basically, according to this,
yeah,
any sin you make, it's basically foolishness. So,
yes.
So basically everybody breaks Shabbos, does whatever they want, foolishness.
Right, so the Talmud raises that possibility that you can make the argument to God that anything that I did wrong was was in a state of incapacity.
Exactly.
You try it. Let me know how that goes.
It's
the Talmud itself that says it. It's not, yes.
But it doesn't make sense.
The 11th commandment is don't be a fool.
Okay. There are a lot of 11th commandments floating around. A very long list of 11th commandments. Yes. Okay. But there's another note here, which is putting a stumbling block before somebody, giving somebody bad advice, may also qualify in Jewish law as what's called mazik. Mazik is someone who harms somebody else, someone who damages somebody else, a vandal. A mazik is a vandal. There's a lot of debate, it's a fascinating discussion in Jewish law regarding why it is, what the basis is for saying that it's prohibited to damage somebody else's property. You look at me like, what do you mean? Because you could look at all the texts, and there are a lot of them in Jewish law that discuss how you have to pay in the event that you damage somebody else's property. If you damage somebody else's person, there are five different types of damages that you're responsible to pay. You have to pay for their time lost from work, and you have to pay for their humiliation, and you have to pay their medical bills, and you have to pay depreciation, and like, you have all these responsibilities. However, could you make the argument And when you damage somebody's property, you have to pay for the property as well. But could you make the argument that it's like the way some people view parking tickets or speeding tickets, which is cost of doing business. If they catch me, I will pay. Right? This is my transaction. But I haven't done anything wrong, morally wrong, ethically wrong, in exceeding the speed limit, or, and that's not true, by the way, don't speed. Let's be clear, that's not legal advice, that's just general advice. But could you make the argument that that there's nothing wrong with damaging somebody's property, just that if you do, you have to pay for it? Where is the biblical law that says don't damage somebody else's property? We do have a biblical law that says don't hit people. But where is the biblical law that says don't damage somebody else's property? So this is actually subject to great debate, including love your neighbor as yourself as one of them. But take a look at source number 15, Rabbi Meir Abulafia, who said, one may not cause any harm to people, whether due to the verse, do not put a stumbling block before the blind, or because of love your neighbor as yourself. So leaving aside love your neighbor right now, but the first verse that he quotes is this one. Meaning, somebody who causes somebody else to stumble is called a mazik, is considered to be somebody who is actively harming somebody else. And in fact, it is prohibited. However, that doesn't necessarily translate into financial liability in Jewish law, for two reasons. Number one, because all you did at most is you spoke. And in general, there isn't financial liability associated with harm caused by speaking. That's number one. In source number 16, I brought you an example of that. The Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, has a responsum dealing with a case in which there is somebody who has a non-Jewish person who is working on their behalf in the capacity of an Eved. I'm not going into the laws of Eved right now, but call it a quasi-slave status. And along comes another Jew and says to this person who is working, you know, if you convert to Judaism, he has to free you. And he converts to Judaism, and then he is, in fact, freed. So the question now is, does the person who gave that advice, is he liable? Because he cost this person the Eved relationship. And the answer is no. He's not liable because...
Spiritually, he just helped him.
Well, he helped the other one. He didn't help the person who's out, the worker. But the answer is... speaking does not incur financial liability. That's one point. And then the other point is that it's what's called grumma. The harm caused with bad advice is called grumma. Grumma means indirect causation. It's only indirect that you cause harm. If you cause harm indirectly, you're not responsible financially. So in source number 17, I gave you an example of this. The example is somebody throws something of his from the roof. Let's say you have somebody who's moving, and he has certain items that is just too much of a pain for him to carry them downstairs. So he puts cushions down below. He gets all the permits and everything. Everything's being done above board. He puts cushions down below, and he's dropping his stuff out the window onto the cushions. You're walking along on the street, and you think it would be really funny if you move the cushions. So the other fellow doesn't notice. And he drops his stuff out the window, and the cushions aren't there, or even worse, he threw the stuff out the window. It's a very tall building. Stuff hasn't reached the ground yet. You pull the cushion away, the stuff smashes on the ground. So the first position in source number 17 in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, is the person who removes the cushions is liable. However, Rabbi Isserles, writing the Ashkenazi portion of the Code of Jewish Law, says not so fast. All you did was cause harm indirectly. Because he dropped the thing. You just pulled away the cushion. So therefore, maybe you're not responsible because the harm you cause is indirect. So too, in the case of bad advice, we can argue that all you did was something that was indirect and therefore you're not responsible. You follow?
But it was very foreseeable. That's very foreseeable.
So Michael says, not so fast. Because it's very foreseeable. And in fact, there is a category in Jewish law called garmi. Garmi is a version of grumma. It is indirect causation where it's still a fairly direct and foreseeable result. And the rule is indeed that you are liable for it. So the I didn't bring the actual case in number 18 that leads to this. I just mentioned that we do follow the rule that you're liable for gammy, but I'll explain the case. The case is the following. You are a money changer. Okay? You have a business in which, instead of being, you know, today you have vending machines for it, fine, but back in the day, you would actually sit in the marketplace, and people would bring you their coins, and you would, and then you would either change the currency for them into whatever they wanted, or you would validate the currency. You would say, this is actually valid, and therefore you can accept it in your transaction. That was the position of being a money changer. Somebody comes to you and shows you a coin and says, can I accept this? You look at it and you say, yeah, looks fine to me. You were about to head out for your coffee break. You were very tired. You didn't really look at it closely. You said, yeah, it's fine. They accepted the coin. Then they tried to use it in a future transaction. And sure enough, the coin was invalid. You had made a mistake. So the question is, are you liable? So part of this is a malpractice discussion. What level of training did you have? Were you indemnified? Had you been served? That's a whole other discussion. But the point here is, on the one hand, the harm you caused was indirect. You said to him, this coin is good. Okay, so he accepted the coin. The harm you did was indirect. But the other way to look at it is that it was a direct and foreseeable result of you saying to him, this coin is good, when in fact it was not good. And that's called garmi, and you are liable. So to take that back to our discussion here, the point for us is, in the event that you give a you give somebody bad advice that you know they're very likely to follow and to get burned on, then you could indeed be liable in Jewish law for garmi. I'll give you an actual case in number 21. Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau was a prominent judge on Israeli courts. He passed away, it's got to be now about 6 or 7 years ago. But he wrote what is in many ways the definitive work on Jewish business law called Pitrei Choshen. So he writes the following. An investment advisor who advises to make a bad investment would appear to be liable under the law of one who shows a dinar to a money changer. If you give them bad investment advice, you're like the money changer who said the bad coin was okay. And a tax advisor who causes a client a loss via his advice would appear to be judged under the law of one who shows a dinar to a money changer. So from a Jewish law perspective, you could well be liable. You caused that person harm by giving them bad advice. So putting all of this together now, what we're saying is, from a law society perspective, you are certainly responsible to advise the client in the manner of a competent lawyer. That advice may even go beyond specific and strictly defined legal advice to call it advice of risk. Although the wording used in the ruling was business advice, do with it what you will. From a Jewish law perspective, there's a responsibility not to give people bad advice, and there's even a responsibility not to omit advice. You have to tell people what they need to know. This is why we're always involved in each other's business. And even if the argument is he's not really unaware, he is aware, there may still be a responsibility to give that person advice. Failure to give that advice may constitute a form of harm, of vandalism, which may even carry liability for it, although it's not entirely clear. There also is the general issue of love your neighbor as yourself, protect other people's property. If other people's property is lost, you have to return it to them. Those elements are there as well. Yes?
Can I think about this? Is there like a rule for release? Like if you're an advisor, does it help you get to draft your release and set out all the risks and get your client?
Right. So it seems that there is. We discussed it a little bit when we had a session on conflict of interest a while back. And we had said then that there are cases in which a release, you know, fully detailed and making sure they know what exactly they're getting into and so on, may indeed be acceptable. The answer is that releases may well work. In the same way that, to go back to Moshe's case, you sell somebody the Shatnez clothing and you just tell them, this is Shatnez, you better get it checked, and you've done your responsibility, you fulfilled your responsibility. Last note on this is in source number 2, note 22. goes back to the point about doing it in writing, which a couple of people have mentioned. So I bring you this note from a judge. The respondent is a lawyer with many areas of experience in the area of family law. Notwithstanding this experience, he was unable to provide the court with any evidence that he provided the client with an opinion as to the merits of the application to vary either before the investigation and discovery were completed or afterwards. He says he urged the client to consider settlement prior to the commencement of trial. They were adamant the matter should proceed. I am satisfied that a lawyer in this situation should have clearly documented in writing that he or she had advised the client not to proceed, but that the client insisted on proceeding to trial. The respondent was unable to provide any such written evidence to the court. Ms. LMP and Mr. JM have denied they received any such advice from the respondent, and where there is a dispute between the oral evidence of the lawyer and the client, I must give the client the benefit of the doubt. By his own acknowledgement, the respondent has many years of experience as a family law lawyer. I cannot imagine him failing to protect himself with, quote, self-serving memoranda, if not a document signed by the client, if his version of the facts were accurate. So get it in writing is a very important point. Right? After all of the discussion about, again, from the Law Society's stance, the definition of a competent lawyer, and from the halachic stance, the issue of lifnei iver, if you are going to give the client advice, make sure that you document it, or you could run into trouble later on. That's all on our first issue, and that's the bulk of the discussion that we have. Yeah.
Is it enough that you send, like in our day and age, you just send an email? So it's not like, if you send an email and it's clear that you've sent the email, it's not that they have to answer you.
Right. So the question is, do you need verification from them? Right. Right. So I would say two things. Number one is, in general, you are best off with as full a documentation as you can get, and the email I think is not quite there. And especially because in our day and age as well, emails go to spam. There's a certain lawyer sitting at this table who gets all the notifications for this class, but for some reason I always get a bounce message back from him, and I don't know whether he has actually received those notifications or not. I think that you want to take the step of being sure that they actually received it. Okay, Miriam, Raquel, and then.
What about level of expertise? Let's say you're a sole practitioner and someone brings you something that's a little bit beyond, and you figure, I think I can stretch. How am I going to grow if I don't stretch? You know, I can't always stay in that tiny little bubble of my knowledge. What's the approach there? And,
right.
and you may not know everything. You may have tried, you know, your very best, but, you know, you didn't know what you didn't know.
Right. So the Law Society's rules mention specifically that a lawyer who is competent is going to get advice from others on areas that are outside their expertise. I think that if you feel like it's close enough that I could do this, you would have a responsibility to advise the client that this isn't something you've done before. You know, I think the client has to be aware of what you're doing in order for it to be considered acceptable. That's just based on the Law Society's rules, not from any particular cases that I've seen. From going back into the halachic perspective, you would certainly be responsible to let the person know. Because the person walks into the lawyer's office and just assumes lawyers know everything. Right? They don't understand special. You know, a layperson doesn't understand specialization. And therefore, I would think in order to avoid lifnei iver, one would really need to have advised the client fully. Raquel?
Yeah, well, the discussion we've been having so far, the halachic piece of it, is not really about giving bad advice, right? And I think everybody agrees you shouldn't give bad advice, right? Like, the starting question of today was, what do you do when you give the advice and the client has a much higher risk tolerance and basically rejects your reasonable suggestion, but also in the context of risk, where it's not. The downside is they're going to be, you know, over some iser in halakha, which is clearly bad. But like, it's risk. It might go well. It might go badly. I'm a very risk-averse person. You have more risk tolerance. Like, if you think it's a bad case, you're probably going to turn the client away. But it's a question of how much risk tolerance do you have. That's not really, like, that doesn't seem to be the same discussion we've been having like on the halakha yet. And I'm just kind of
right.
Wondering more about that nuance of, first of all, risk, as opposed to clear downside, only bad. Right? It's a, you know, in the legal context, it's clear downside, only bad. I assume you're not going to get litigation. I don't do litigation, but I'm assuming litigators don't take files where they think you're definitely going to lose on this one, right? So number one, what about where it's not clear, some risk, right? Really question of risk. And also, coming back to the first question of, you've given the good advice. Nobody thinks you should give bad advice. But you've given the advice. You said, here are the risks. This is what you're looking at. Me personally, I have a low risk tolerance. I probably wouldn't proceed. You have a high risk tolerance. And the person says, I want to proceed. And I just feel like we haven't quite.
Right. Okay. So two different elements in this discussion. I'm just going to remind people also to make sure that they sign in. But in terms of the first part of it, the fact that you don't necessarily think it's bad advice, but as you said, different people, different personalities, different tolerances, not to mention different levels of investment. You know, for me, the lawyer, I could take it or leave it. But for this person who has a history where it was, you know, a case and it involved them and they had expectations and there was a relationship or whatever it was, they may well be willing to pursue just on that basis. So I think the responsibility is to make sure that they're doing it with open eyes, right? That they're not fooled into something. Then you can't do much beyond that, but make sure that it's because they are risk tolerant and not because they're fooled. The second part of it is what I want to get to under withdrawal. So I do want to get to that. So I'll take one more question and then we're going to go further. Yeah.
Alonso, is there not a difference? The e-fare applies if you can go down the street and get the same service somewhere else.
Yeah.
And if he says, well, if you don't want to do this deal for me, I'll go down to the next guy and do it. I thought that was an exception.
Right. So this is a thorny issue. The Talmud does discuss, when it gives you the case of Lifnei Iver, the difference between Chad Iver Denahara and Trey Iver Denahara. Meaning, we mentioned before not giving a cup of wine to a Nazir, to someone who has sworn off wine. So the Gemara distinguishes between where you and the Nazir are on the same bank of a river, such that you can pick up the cup and give it to him, or he's going to bend down and take it, but you haven't materially changed his fate. Or the case in which he's on one side of the river, you're on the other side of the river with the wine, and you actually pass the wine across, where you have enabled that which he couldn't have done on his own. So you're correct that we do have such a distinction. There is a debate in the Shulchan Aruch as to whether you can rely on that, whether that's an acceptable distinction to make, to say, if he could have done it without me, then I'm okay participating. But even within that view that says more leniently that if he could have done it without me, he could have gotten this service elsewhere, I'm not responsible, that's still not going to apply in a case in which I provide him material assistance. Because then you go from Lifnei Iver to what's called Misayeya. I'm actually assisting him in the act, and the fact that somebody else could have assisted him doesn't really matter so much. There's more to be said, but you're right that this is a consideration. So I'm going to do the incapacity topic relatively quickly. Or not. I'm going to do the incapacity topic. Either way, we're stopping in 90 minutes. Don't panic. But let's see what we can do here. So I brought you in source number 23 from the Substitute Decisions Act. The definition of somebody who needs a substitute decision maker for property issues. This is extreme. It sounds extreme. It's not like just somebody who's just generally risk averse, a risk taker. A person is incapable of managing property if the person is not able to understand information that is relevant to making a decision in the management of his or her property, or is not able to appreciate the reasonably foreseeable consequences of a decision or lack of a decision. I just realized I didn't go back to the vignette yet. Go back to the first page, please. I'm sorry. I forgot. We have to go through the case. So it's source number 2, item 2. Dr. Shulman was a geriatric psychiatrist. He had been R's physician since April 8th. He said that R was a voluntary patient who accepted the medication prescribed. He described R as being intelligent, stated that R had no cognitive problems. He was able to understand the relevant issues concerning management of finances. The doctor said the patient was manic and grandiose. He had no doubt this was a result of his bipolar disorder, which had not been properly treated since early 2008. He said that capable persons are entitled to make bad or reckless financial decisions. He noted that R had purchased a 1972 Ford Mustang vehicle for $72,000, and he was required to make payments of over $1,000 per month. R told him his total pension income was $1,300 per month. R had been cycling his credit by paying off one credit card with another. He had not paid his mortgage or any of his debts. While R knew the extent of his income and the magnitude of his debt, he was unable to appreciate that eventually he could not keep living well beyond his means. Does this person have capacity?
No.
I get a clear no.
Yeah.
Right? He's paying $1,000 out of his $1,300 a month for this 1972 Ford Mustang. Sorry?
He paid $72,000.
That's a good point as well. Maybe it was an electric Mustang.
He's going to end up not having a place to live.
Right.
The Mustang.
Now he's paying rent.
People are allowed to make bad decisions.
Yes, people are, and that's even what the doctor, playing lawyer, said in that.
This doctor is like extremely well respected in the incapacity.
Yeah. Okay.
That kind of changes things a little bit.
Okay. Well, no.
The reason I would say that is because he is very, very knowledgeable about the legal standards.
Uh-huh.
He's not a lawyer, which is also relevant, but he has these assessments all the time. He knows what the legal standards are. Doesn't mean he gets dead for again, but he knows.
Right. Okay. Thank you. So the standard set up in the Substitute Decisions Act in number 23 is that they have to be able to understand information relevant to making a decision and to appreciate the reasonably foreseeable consequences of that decision. So I brought you in number 24, the standards for who makes such an assessment. So you have to be a member of the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, or a member of the College of Psychologists of Ontario, or any of the items in source number 24. Have to complete the qualifying course for assessors. You have to have continuing education courses, minimum annual number of assessments. You have to be a professional who fits these criteria in order to make the assessment. And the standard is the standard of understanding and appreciating, which number 25 off of the Government of Ontario's website, I brought you their definition. Understand refers to the ability to understand information that is relevant to making a decision, while appreciate refers to the ability to appreciate the reasonably foreseeable consequences of a decision or lack of decision. So a person who lacks the ability to understand is one who lacks the factual knowledge base and skills needed to manage the decision-making demands of their circumstances, and they can't be educated in that regard, or lacks the ability to intellectually understand the options for meeting their financial or personal care needs, or cannot communicate their choice or decision. So either they don't have the knowledge, or they can't understand what their options are. A person who lacks the ability to appreciate is one who lacks the ability to realistically appraise the risk and likely outcome of a decision or lack of decision, or lacks the ability to plan, to take action, to implement the plan, or lacks the ability to rationally manipulate information to reach a reasoned decision consistent with personal values free from delusional beliefs. So that's what you're getting as your secular standard here. I gave you some examples of this in sources 26, 27, and 28. They are actually 26 and 27, where in 26, yeah, I'm going to skip the examples here just in the interest of being able to cover a little more ground, but you can see the examples that I brought you in 26 and 27. The 28, though, you go back to the case that I brought in the vignette. The doctor conceded that R was not suffering from hallucinations or delusions. However, he had, quote, impaired reality testing. R felt that he deserved things. R was intelligent, he could engage in conversation and articulate his position. Nevertheless, R was unable to appreciate that he was about to lose his home, and that he could not continue to lead the lifestyle he wanted to lead. He remained grandiose despite the severe financial difficulties he had encountered. The doctor said his patient had not improved much while in hospital. He said that in order to determine whether he had the capacity to make financial decisions, he needed to obtain information from the family. The doctor said the patient's sons had told him of problems. He looked at those problems and the patient's manic presentation to him in coming to his finding, which was, in fact, lack of capacity in the end. But the issue here is, from a secular standpoint, lack of ability to understand the facts or the options, lack of the ability to appreciate the consequences, the outcome of one's actions. In halacha as well, you're allowed to make bad decisions without being labeled incapacitated. Someone who is risk tolerant is risk tolerant. So take a look at source number 29 from the Rambam, from Maimonides, in his Laws of Inheritance. When a child matures, even if he eats and drinks excessively and squanders his property and travels a bad path, the court may not keep his assets from him and may not appoint a guardian. Person's allowed to make bad decisions. We can't stop him from doing so. They're dealing there, and obviously in a case where the person was, as a minor, somebody who had a guardian, and now in adulthood wants to be able to act on his own. The what about definitions of incapacity? So in halacha as well, you have different models of incapacity. There is inability to appreciate, and there is inability to understand. There are two categories of inability to appreciate. One is called the shoteh, and the other is called the nechpaz. Take a look, please, at source number 30 for the definition of a shoteh. Shoteh is usually translated as insane. It's a legal term. A shoteh is disqualified from testifying. This is not only a shoteh who wanders without clothing and breaks implements and throws stones, but anyone whose mind is torn, so that his mind is confused perpetually on some matter, even though he speaks and inquires on point in other areas. He is disqualified and considered a shoteh. Someone whose behavior is irrational in some way, even if not in all ways. Now, the context here is about testimony in court. That's not about everything, but we will see applications that go beyond testimony in court. But that's a person who is irrational and therefore unable to appreciate the consequences of a decision. The other case is nechbaz. Nechbaz means somebody who is hasty. In source number 31, Maimonides gives you the case of... Well, he gives you two cases. One is called petty, and the other is nechbaz, so I guess I'll explain both. Petty is somebody who has failure to understand. Is somebody whose intellect just doesn't enable him to understand. Nechbaz, hasty, is somebody who has failure to appreciate consequences. He says, those who are especially foolish, that's the petty, who do not recognize contradictory statements, do not understand matters as other normal people do. Also, those who are confused and hasty in their minds, that's the nechpaz, and those who are especially foolish are in the category of shotim. They're also considered to be insane for our purposes. It is as the judge sees it. One cannot specify a mindset in writing, meaning he says this isn't the sort of thing where he can give you specific litmus tests that you can apply to determine this person is hasty. This person is foolish. It's more something that the judge is going to have to assess based on the judge's perception. So what I'm trying to show you here is that you have a similar set of standards in Jewish law and in general in terms of the rules in Ontario. You have somebody who has inability to understand, that's the petty. You have somebody who has inability to appreciate consequences, and that is the shoteh, or the person who is hasty. And in the end, it's a subjective judgment. I'm skipping a few sources which would have discussed a little bit more nuance in this area. But take a look at number 38, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, writing in 18th century, it should be 19th century, Hungary, says, judging the matter of shotim is impossible other than through the eyes of a judge who understands his nature. One cannot clarify in writing his nature. As Maimonides wrote, the judge only has what his eyes see. This isn't something that you can provide a really good written test. That brings us to the topic of withdrawal. can a lawyer, should a lawyer withdraw when they feel like the client is not listening to them and is in fact taking risks that they believe are a mistake? I brought you a case in the third part of number two. It's a long case, but you can get the idea of it very, very quickly. If anyone scanned it, you already know what I'm talking about. It's a case involving a client who proves to be very, very difficult. The lawyer on the case, Ms. Marin, believed the variety of financial losses, this is what I underlined, the variety of financial losses the client wanted to claim were too remote. She thinks the client is demanding way too much here and is not going to get it. The client is dissatisfied with the accounting expert hired on her behalf. The client believes she is poorly represented at discovery. The client believes, you can go down and read it. They deeply scared, you have completely lost touch with our level of suffering. The lawyers, Gluckstein, ultimately send the client a letter saying that, you know, you need to have trust in order for a lawyer-client relationship to work. You're saying you're not going to look for alternative counsel and that you trust our services. This is to make sure that we're all on the same page. The client says, yes, we're still on the same page. However, things get worse. Ms. Marin, who was representing the client, goes on maternity leave, and now Mr. Gluckstein takes over the file. Things are not going well, and ultimately Gluckstein wants out. And they walk away. And the question is, can you walk away when you're giving advice and the client isn't listening and the client is angry at you all the time? Are you able to walk away? So generally speaking, the Law Society is not happy with the idea of withdrawing from representation. I brought you in source number 37. A lawyer shall not withdraw from representation of a client except for good cause and on reasonable notice to the client. Right? And in the commentary, although the client has the right to terminate the lawyer-client relationship at will, the lawyer does not enjoy the same freedom of action. Having undertaken the representation of a client, the lawyer should complete the task as ably as possible unless there is justifiable cause for terminating the relationship. And further, subject to the rules about criminal proceedings, the direction of the tribunal, where there has been a serious loss of confidence between the lawyer and the client, the lawyer may withdraw if there is a serious loss of confidence. And in the commentary, what does that mean? A lawyer may have a justifiable cause for withdrawal in circumstances indicating a loss of confidence. For example, if a lawyer is deceived by their client, the client refuses to accept and act upon the lawyer's advice on a significant point. A client is persistently unreasonable or uncooperative in a material respect. So, you know, that note where the client refuses to accept and act upon the lawyer's advice on a significant point is really what matters most here. You might say, as the lawyer, I don't want this case. Whether I don't want this case because they're really hard to deal with, the client is really hard to deal with, it's just not worth it for me, or because morally I feel like I can't represent them because I'm not getting through and they're going to hurt themselves in the end and I don't want to be part of this kind of process. Those are both potential considerations. So from a, you know, you've seen what the Law Society writes about where they aren't following your advice. As a general rule, though, you're not able to back out. It has to be pretty extreme in order for you to be able to walk away. In the Gluckstein case that I brought you, in number 38, the judge upholds the right to walk away. I have reviewed the record provided by both parties. There is ample evidence that the client was critical of the Gluckstein firm, did not believe they were adequately representing her. It is clear that she had lost confidence in their ability to represent her to the standards that she demanded. She did not agree with their advice, would not accept the perceived deficiencies with her case. Accordingly, I find that Gluckstein had good cause to terminate the CFA. It is possible, based on the lack of trust from the client, and the client refusing their advice, to say, okay, I'm going to walk away. I don't need to be on this case. That indeed can happen. Actually, I think it was Aliza Caroli who gave me this case. She's not here right now, but okay. What about from a Jewish law perspective? So I think that from a halachic perspective, we would want the lawyer to withdraw if possible, if the client will not listen and the client is actually harming themselves. It is true that the lawyer is not directly harming the client in this case. We talk about grama, garmi, and so on, but the lawyer is able to say, I just don't feel like I can be party to this. And in fact, the lawyer, from a religious perspective, should not be party to something where their participation enables somebody to be harmed. If you take a look at, I'm jumping 39, it's not necessary for this, but you take a look at number 40 from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law. You know that in a rabbinical court, we require two witnesses to testify. The witnesses have certain standards in order to be acceptable as witnesses. What if you know that you yourself are a kosher witness? The other person, though, in the set, your partner witness, so to speak, should be disqualified. But the judge doesn't know that. You know that. By dint of your participation, this invalid witness's words will be accepted. Do you proceed to testify and say, well, it's not my business? So the Rabbi Yosef Kara rules here in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, even a kosher witness who knows that his fellow witness is wicked, but the judges do not recognize his wickedness, may not testify with him. Even though he knows the testimony is true, even though you know that what's going to be said is true, you can't be party to something which is going to lead to somebody being harmed if there's impropriety along the way. And it goes without saying, regarding a kosher witness who knows testimony for someone, he knows that the second witness with him is lying, he certainly may not testify. You can't be part of that. And so the lawyer may well say, I don't want to be part of this. I don't want to be part of this if it's going to cause somebody to be harmed. And therefore, I wish to invoke Rule 3.7 and, in fact, withdraw. From a Jewish law standpoint, remember, there is no position of lawyer in a Beit Din, in a rabbinical court. Lawyers have existed for a very long time in rabbinical courts. It goes back 2,000 years minimum. We have the terminology for it already in the Mishnah. But there wasn't a formal position. So when I talk about whether he's able to withdraw or not able to withdraw, I have to extrapolate from discussions of, in general, where you're involved in something in which somebody is getting hurt because of your involvement, and say, as a general rule, you are able to withdraw, and in fact may even be required to withdraw, rather than enable somebody else's harm. And therefore, the lawyer here, who feels like the client isn't listening, may well have a religious duty to withdraw rather than be party to this. Exceptions would be if you're going to leave the client in a worse state by withdrawing, right? Because now they don't have representation at all. Or potentially, if this could actually seriously endanger the lawyer's ability to eat, you may be able to actually retain the case. It's beyond the scope of what we can talk about right now. But I want to do a summary over the 3 minutes that we have left. Yeah. Sorry. No, I'm not. I'm talking about a lawyer.
I'm talking about Jewish court.
No, the Tohen is a modern position. Yeah. If you see at the bottom of the sheet, I gave you review questions. So I had a feeling we weren't going to get to the cognitive bias material, so I included some material on the sheet, but I didn't include that even in the review questions. Must a lawyer encourage a client to settle where the client has already demonstrated an aggressive stance and an unwillingness to listen to contrary advice? So from a law society perspective?
Yes.
Obviously, yes, and it doesn't matter that they're not willing to listen. From a Jewish law perspective, it depends on how you look at it. If this is bad advice, if having them, well, first of all, you have to ask the question of, am I responsible for passive bad advice, for simply not telling them? We said that, yes, I am responsible for passive bad advice. I have to go out and actually tell people what they should do. However, this person here is not unable to see. This person says, I know and I don't care and I'm not interested in you telling me otherwise. If I accept the distinction by Rabbi Chaim Odzer to say that where it's just bad for him, he's not called blind, he knows what's wrong, then I don't have any responsibility further to this person. if I don't accept his distinction, then yes, then I am responsible to actually give him the advice that he doesn't want to hear. Three halachic concerns in giving a client bad advice. Number one, your duty as the person's lawyer. He hired you with certain expectations that you would give him the advice that a competent lawyer gives. Number two, lifnei iver, not to cause the person to stumble by giving them bad advice or by failing to give them good advice. And number three, it actually makes you a mazik. You're somebody who is potentially vandalizing their property, so to speak, by this bad advice, aside from the other issues of love your neighbor and so on. We have to define ability to appreciate and ability to understand when it comes to the assessment of capacity. Ability to appreciate means that he understands the consequences of what he does. Ability to understand means he understands the facts of the case and what his options are. That's the general assessment of capacity. From a Jewish law perspective, we have a parallel structure. Shoteh is the person who is unable to appreciate the consequences. A person who is hasty, nechpaz, also unable to appreciate the consequences. And then you have peti, the person who is unable to understand the facts of what are involved. May a lawyer withdraw due to the lawyer's belief the client's decisions are self-destructive. So if the client is not taking important advice on a significant point, or there's an undermining of trust, the lawyer may be able to back out. The courts in general are not fans of it, but they will accept it. And from a Jewish law standpoint, there may well be a moral obligation to back out rather than enable the person to engage in self-destructive behavior, assuming you're not leaving the person in a worse position than they were in the first place. I'm going to stick around for questions, but I don't want to hold people past time. So thank you very, very much. And